it's time for Dialogue Conspiracy with political research specialist Mae Brussel, who for 3 years has shared with us her decades' research into political assassinations and abuses of power in this country. Her program relates the news of the week to emerging evidence about the conspiracy which allegedly maintains by force its control over the legislative and judicial processes in America. And now, here's Mae.
Good afternoon. This is Mae Brussel in Carmel, California. Dialogue Conspiracy, I believe it's number 215, and it is September 22nd, 1975. It's quite a week for the news. I came in here with a lot of opinions and information to share with you about the new Patty Hearst arrest and Lynette Squeaky Frome and Howard Hughes' appearance that didn't take place in the New York court. But when I got into the studio, I received a telephone call from a listener in Carmel who told me about the assassination attempt on President Gerald Ford. For those of you who are local, that are just getting this news, there was a shot that went out in the crowd. This will be old news for those of you that get the tape relayed later in a few days. Done by a woman named Sarah Moore, 40 years old, and she allegedly was part of a Feed the Poor program that was going to free Patty Hearst. It's like an old script. It's so tiresome, I almost hate to run down the details. There was this very short motorcade, and a shot went out, and the president wasn't hurt. The woman had been thought of as a security risk, but she was released, and she took a shot that went in the air. And that was that. And that is a wonderful diversionary. It's one more pot shot. And how many more do we have to get until the real one comes is just a matter of time. I've mentioned this before. I have shocked my researchers, fellow researchers, at the Boston conference when they went to talk about conspiracies last January 30th, 1974. And at that time, everyone was horrified about Rockefeller becoming vice president and what control he'd have over the country. And I felt that as researchers from political assassinations that we no longer had to worry only about who shot John Kennedy or Robert Kennedy or Martin Luther King or who arranged that Chappaquiddick accident or who shot George Wallace. But the big problem was to stop the bullet the next time because the same people and the same team since Dallas, Texas, have moved up into a position where they're even better to do it than when they were in on the killing of John Kennedy. And that Ronald Reagan was the number one problem. I said on the radio last night up at KGO in San Francisco, I'm not saying that Reagan knows about this conspiracy plan or how he'll become president, but according to my research, I believe that he is the selected man, just like Richard Nixon was selected many years ago, and that nothing less than bullets will take place to make Ronald Reagan president of the United States. If he has to run as vice president, then Gerald Ford actually will be killed, or maybe Rockefeller. All these pot shots will happen to Ford, and when Rockefeller's defenses are down, Rockefeller's going to get it. But Reagan has very strong links to Claude Kirk in Florida, to organizations Kirk was associated with, that suggest with Nazis in Brazil. Kirk has this Wackenhut Corporation, which is retired FBI men and military men, private police force that now guards our airports. You see the little button on the Wackenhut Corporation. Out here at Fort Ord, the Wackenhut Corporation guards Fort Ord, not hired military, but Wackenhut Corporation. And there's strong links of Reagan to Claude Kirk and the campus at UC Berkeley when Kirk was running for governor of Florida. On his campaign, he promised in one of his speeches to break three universities, and one was the University of California. And what he was running on a campaign for in Florida to break the university in California is a good question, except that there are links through my research and documents that should be examined of these two people and their relationship to each other. And the day that each was elected governor, one in California, one in Florida, they met for lunch in Los Angeles, and the next day, Mr. Kerr, the president of the University of California, was fired, and that was the end of that administration, and he was not given any pay, severance pay, or anything. He was just fired, and the Wackenhut Corporation has been building up its strength, and Reagan and Florida, the links of Florida to Muscle Shoals, Alabama, to the Defense Industry Security Command. I mentioned it last week on the air in regards to the assassination attempt to kill Gerald Ford up in Sacramento. The DISC, the Defense Industry Security Command, according to Penn Jones Jr., the researcher, is has funded Ronald Reagan, and they're behind him. Also, Mr. LaSalle, Senator LaSalle, runs Reagan's campaign, and he's from Nevada. He used to be governor, and LaSalle is a used man, 100%. When Howard Hughes wanted to run the state, when Howard Hughes didn't have to appear for gaming tables, when he bought up all of Vegas, his contacts were, or the Hughes Corporation, were strong with LaSalle, and for all practical purposes, Reagan is a used man. And if that's a faceless person supplying money or energy into your campaign in any way, and the Defense Industry Security Command working along with you or giving you funding, then they intend for you to be president. Now, it's no surprise that a woman was the one who shot in the air. This time, she's 40 years old. Sarah Moore was the one who allegedly shot at this motorcade. A hint that women would become part of the criminal conspiracy section was given by Chief of Police Ed Davis. I don't think these things are coincidental. They went on national television. All the major chiefs of police in the United States are talking about the causes of crime. Every single one of them talked about unemployment and poverty as causes for people to steal and commit crimes. But Chief of Police Ed Davis said, no, it's women, the women's movement. The women are getting into this road to crime. And that was just about a month ago, those meetings and interview. So now we have Patty Hearst, the urban guerrilla terrorist. She signs in at the jail as urban guerrilla. We have Squeaky Fromm, who's been charged with assassination attempt to the president. Now we have another woman, Sarah Moore. And what has women's liberation come to? A bunch of murderers, and again, a smear just like the Red Scare. Years ago, the communist Red Scare that still goes on and on. They now include the women, and you have a bunch of women making the news as the fall guys. They were used. They were used, like Oswald or Sirhan or James Ray. But the speech of Ed Davis about the women, and then this one coming in, and actually Ford wasn't killed, but it keeps the news as a great diversionary also. Congress should be investigating the past political assassinations, particularly with this syndrome. They should at least listen to the researchers and find out what happened in the past and rule out any conspiracy instead of accepting in the headline every week or every other week these assassination attempts. Congress has a bill before it to open up these conspiracies, and this is the time for them to, if you don't understand the past, how can you understand the present? The CIA has been exposed in the past weeks for their germ warfare, biological warfare, for injecting persons unknown to them, experimenting with them, murders by the agencies by giving them these poisons and also accidental deaths with germ warfare. And we've heard about lying of figures in Vietnam and thousands of deaths in Vietnam, and how these were covered up, and the Tet Offensive was possible because of misinformation. And with all of this plus Watergate, the Congress becomes, it seems, more silent. As the evidence comes in overwhelmingly of these crimes, it becomes more silent instead of stampeding and demanding an opening of the past and at least giving researchers like myself a chance to present what we think is happening and present the documentation. And to add injury or insult to injury, the news service that tonight said that Senator Edward Kennedy said he's satisfied with the conclusion of the Warren Commission that his brother, President John Kennedy, was the victim of a lone assassin. Senator Kennedy is satisfied with the conclusion of the Warren Commission that John Kennedy was killed by a lone assassin. Now, that comes just 2 days after the CIA said that they had tape recordings of Oswald in Mexico and telephone conversations that evidently they've held for 13 years, but they had phone conversations of Lee Harvey Oswald taped and on tape. And now Senator Kennedy is saying this. I don't understand the Kennedys at all. We won't go into them. Robert Kennedy Jr. came out last week and said, leave it alone. Don't investigate my father's death. And that seems to be the family policy. It's going to be their position So, like Gerald Ford and members of the Warren Commission and the Kennedy family and the military and the media saying, don't touch it, this is good enough for me. We have to sit back and take one assassination attempt after another. We'll have to take violence in the street. We're going to have to see a lot of blood let loose, a lot of killing, because we have allowed these things to happen. People in this country, instead of getting outraged and demanding that they be open because the evidence exists, we're going to allow more murders and more crimes to take place. And when Ronald Reagan becomes president, he said he didn't think information about assassination should be made available. And if the crime bill, Senate Crime Bill 1, goes through, then there'll be no chance for investigative research. And what it means is that the government has the right to do anything it wants, including murder, and you don't have the right to ask questions, and that makes it legal. And everything in Hitler's government was legal. Everything that he did was according to the courts, but the courts had been manipulated earlier so that when the crimes took place, they were no longer crimes unless you happened to be a gypsy or a Jew or a Catholic or a radical activist or a critic of Hitler's administration. I did want to say more later on the Hughes story. The Hughes suit was thrown out. I've been waiting 2 weeks to see what would happen. A family in New York City by the name of Kurtz, Victor and Ellen Kurtz, filed a suit as stockholders of Hughes Air West and wanted to see Howard Hughes in court. I called them, I talked to their attorney on the phone and sent them a copy of the article I did on the burial of Howard Hughes. The matter was taken to a Supreme Court in New York City, and of course Hughes failed to prove he was alive. The judge said there was no point, this was an arena to take advantage of his desire for privacy, and it would encourage a cruel sport and stage a spectacle for publicity for more unworthy purposes. That was the decision of the court, that the stock manipulation was thrown out because this was just taking advantage of Mr. Hughes' privacy. And in addition, the judge, his name was Hughes, as a coincidence, said, this is his quotation, it would be an exercise in futility to prove that Howard Hughes is alive. He said, whatever the motives of the plaintiff's counsel in making this application, it is at best an exercise in futility, wasting the time of the court and having no foundation whatever for the court to grant the requested relief, wrote Justice Hughes. And they threw the case out and said that whether or not to prove he's alive or make him legally dead was an exercise in futility. Well, the New York Times has a long article. It's the September 14th, 1975 article. It's about 15 pages in the magazine section. Hopefully in a week or two I'll outline it and read it for you on the air in case you don't get the Sunday New York Times. But it's written by James Phelan, and this is the title of the article in bold letters, is Howard Hughes Beyond the Law. It says, trying to apply orderly legal processes to the billionaire recluse, the judge said, is like twisting a ghost. Now here's a man whose documents, according to Robert Mayo, said keep the war going 2 more years. It's good for helicopter business. Here's a man who said, after Martin Luther King was killed, the blacks have gone far enough for 100 years. Here's a man who wanted to buy up the Bahamas and own that, who wanted to own all of Nevada, who was allowed to come in and take all the gaming tables and have huge contacts all over the world with airways and television and media and sports programs, which are interesting and important because of the activities of the athletes in the Patricia Hearst kidnapping case. And I'm going to, as I say, break it down for you. And for those of you that want to read it yourselves, get the New York Times Magazine, September 14, 75, Howard Hughes Beyond the Law. Now, he was named early. Richard Nixon apologized at the time of this little secret fund he had, the checker speech, the dog that came from Houston that was from Howard Hughes for his daughter. Howard Hughes' name came up all through Richard Nixon's career, loans to Richard Nixon's brother, used money at the Watergate, used money to Hubert Humphrey, Larry O'Brien worked for Howard Hughes, the grand jury testimony. V. Howard Hunt shows that he worked for Howard Hughes going up to Chappaquiddick investigating when he was at Theda Beard in Colorado. The name abuse comes through his close association with Lockheed Aircraft and Thane Caesar, the man who allegedly shot that second gun in the Ambassador Hotel, who had a gun go off, who stood behind Robert Kennedy, was a plumber and maintenance man from Lockheed. And it's not a very firm connection from Hughes to Lockheed to Thane Caesar, but there are better connections through Howard Hughes to Aristotle Onassis to Roy Cohn, the attorney, and interlocking to Lockheed that make these conspiracies and assassinations a number one priority. And a number one priority behind all of this is to find the elusive Mr. Howard Hughes, and he can't come to court. They say it's impossible. Nobody will serve him, and he won't come to court, and that's all there is to that. Well, we'll just do a minute about Lynette Squeaky Frome and then get on to the SLA stories. Squeaky Frome was interviewed by Marilyn Baker, and Marilyn Baker is going to help her get a book out. She's a woman who wrote about the SLA. If I had enough money for a lawyer, I would sue her and try to stop that book. Would have stopped it a long time ago if I could, such as a researcher, Ted Rock, tried to stop Second Unit Senator, Special Unit Senator, a book on Robert Kennedy written by Robert Houghton. These books have no basis in fact. They're figments of the imagination, and they're grandiose to fit the cover story of a large national conspiracy syndrome. Well, Marilyn Baker was up there, and she offered $1,000 towards the bail of Miss Frome, and they were on television together. Miss Frome was Sandra Good was talking, Miss Frome's friend, but Marilyn Baker was at court to offer to put up $1,000 towards Miss Frome's freedom. And the publisher would be Macmillan Publisher. That's the publisher that would do the book. Well, that's interesting because Macmillan had a small division. I don't know if they still have it or not. They had a division in Los Angeles, California in 1969 called Glencoe Press, G-L-E-N-C-O-E Press, in Beverly Hills, California. And that press printed for the Los Angeles Police Department. And they also printed a book called Children of Change, which was linked to the Manson family. And this book was put out by Henry Kaiser, Aluminum and Chemical Corporation, and a member of Navy Intelligence who knew Charles Watson, who gave acid to the Manson family in Los Angeles, did the artwork for this book. And this book came out just a month before the Sharon Tate LaBianca murders. And this person had interlocking links to some very important action that should be investigated in Los Angeles. Well, that's the publisher, the same publisher that put out this little book. Macmillan is offering money to Lynette Squeaky Frome, and it will come to Marilyn Baker, and she will write another story, and we'll still have another story, but it won't be the real story of the Manson family any more than her book was the story of the SLA. I did a show on Dialogue Conspiracy October the 6th, 1971, on the links of Charlie Manson and Charles Watson to military intelligence, and I just got out that tape cassette today just to check the date, and someday maybe I'll read you some sections of it. I had it transcribed, written up as a matter of fact, and maybe I'll play some of it, repeat on the air for you. November 17th, 1971, on Dialogue Conspiracy, I had as my guest Preston Guillory, retired sheriff, who is now a private investigator, who was in on the arrest of the Manson family at the Spahn Ranch. And after the sheriffs released the family and let them go to the Barker Ranch, he retired from the police department. He called people at Los Angeles Free Press. He said, there's a political conspiracy going in. I'm quitting Peter Pitch's sheriff office. He claims that the murders were allowed to happen and that the sheriff thought that they would be killing blacks and Black Panthers. And then lo and behold, the Manson swooped down at the Sharon Tate household and the LaBianca household, where seven people were murdered. And the murders were done by Charles Watson, not Manson. Manson wasn't in the house at the time of the murders, but they became known as the Manson murders, and Manson took the cover rap on that. Sandra Good was on television, as I say, with Marilyn Baker, and she was talking about all the bloodshed in America, and the voices would be silenced and throats cut and lots of killing and slicing and cutting. And Marilyn Baker asked what kind of people, and she said people that are contaminating the earth, that are polluting the earth, and she named specifically Jerry Rubin and Abby Hoffman. And I thought that was interesting because it just came on our news here Friday night, and I could just watch on Channel 9 a rerun of the play on the Chicago conspiracy trial, where Abby Hoffman accused the judge of being a Jew and comparing their trial to Germany and saying, I'm a Jew, and comparing the trial to Nazi Germany, where everything was legal in Nazi Germany. And then Jerry Rubin came on. They each were allowed to give a speech after they were convicted of their charges there in Chicago. So it was interesting that she named these names because the violence in the Bay Area, I think of Dr. Marcus Foster, who was killed by the cyanide bullets, and Dr. Blackburn lived, it was a different bullet. And I said, there's this racism coming down there under the front of these radical groups. And then we had Popeye Jackson, the leader of the United Prisoners Union, that was killed. That's two blacks. And we have now two Jews named Abby Hoffman and Jerry Rubin. I noticed they didn't mention Tom Hayden or some of the other people in the Chicago trial. But these two people who clearly identified themselves at that trial for and were named as polluting the earth. And I think of the quotations of Charles Lindbergh, the great environmentalist, who wanted to conserve the fish and the fowl and the earth, who all of his life worried about the environment, but who was sorry that Hitler lost World War II because we'd get the mixing of races and it set us back eons of years. And he thought we were wrong to go in there because Hitler would have purified the races, which is a way of stopping pollution in their head. So when you're talking about environment or pollution, there are a great many people, and don't believe there are a few. There are many people who believe that by getting rid of Jews and blacks and Chicanos, oh, Chuck is here giving me a kiss. Go away, Chuck. That if you get rid of these people, you will not pollute the earth. And this is their mentality for whatever it's worth. And if you don't agree with my interpretation, just see who gets the death list. To show the racism in this, I might have mentioned it last week, and I think I should bring it up again, that Sandra Good did say that she gave a death threat to Paul Eberle, the Los Angeles Star, the publisher of the Los Angeles Star, and his wife. And she said, I'm going to kill your wife, and they would send in black people, and then his wife would be cut up into pieces. Well, why send black people when these are white people that have the intent to do the crime? And I realized, too, that Paul Eberle was the first person to publish an article that I did on the SLA as the CIA. He's been very much into sex and pornography, if you call it pornography, recently. But earlier, he was very political. He was very political. And he did, my interest in the SLA started in 1973. We might as well get into that now, and I'll tell you about the article I sent him in March 15, 74, called The SLA is the CIA. And question mark, does Howard Hughes finance these violence centers from his medical foundation in Florida? The money seems to be going to the hospitals that are doing the electrode implants and the doctors that are doing the surgical and drug manipulation of the head. They seem to be coming and connected to the medical foundation of Florida, that tax-free foundation. And Paul Eberle published that, and he's done other political articles, but this was an early article on the SLA. Patty Hearst was kidnapped in February, and in March 15th, Paul already had the story, and I'll talk about that in a minute. We'll go into my SLA publications, but I have a toss-up here in time-wise of what to cover, whether to go back to my old articles in the Berkeley Barb and Paul's article that I did for the LA Star, or reiterate what I told Randolph Hearst in a letter on KLRB. I read it here, September the 1st, I gave indications that Patty Hearst would be found in 3 weeks. And that was Monday on KLRB on the 1st. But August 30th, I sent a letter to Mr. Randolph Hearst, and I explained that he spent a lot of energy and time and money and emotion in this kidnapping, and that now it was time for Patty to be produced. And the reason I said she would be found that I gave on KLRB, and I put in the letter, was that Wayne Lewis is now alleging that Patrick Gray's nephew took part in the FBI killing of Donald DeFries and in their foreknowledge of the imminent murders, and that also at the same time that he was hired to take DeFries' place after DeFries was killed was the same day or week that I was presenting an article to the Berkeley Barb that Donald DeFries would be murdered as the first black Lee Harvey Oswald working for the FBI. I also told Randolph Hearst that Mr. J.J. Arms had been mentioned in an article in Newsweek, September 1st, 1975, that if he had $500,000, he would find Patricia Hearst. He's a private detective who helped make that getaway down in Texas, in Mexico, rather, where the Kaplan boy, Joel Kaplan boy, was. They made a movie called The Great Getaway. And I said in the letter to Mr. Hearst that Mr. J.J. Arms of El Paso, Texas, had said in Newsweek that if I get the green light, I'll find her in 2 or 3 weeks or less. I don't mess around. And because the Scotts were to appear before the grand jury, Vicki and Mickey Scott and her husband were supposed to go to the grand jury in Pennsylvania, I knew that Patricia Hearst would have to be produced within 3 weeks. Because of this announcement in Newsweek, the intent to find her, to get her, they knew where she was. Because Walter Scott also, the brother, said of the man allegedly who took Patty Hearst from Los Angeles back to Vegas and then to New York and Pennsylvania, Walter Scott had said that the Scotts were tired of her and wanted to return her. And then he was discredited as being drunk and having been in a mental hospital. And so I felt that the press conference that was held in San Francisco on Mr. Wayne Lewis, and then the grand jury ordering the Scotts to appear in Pennsylvania, and with Walter Scott talking, and with Mr. J.J. Arms saying that he can find her in 3 weeks, then it would be the best interest of the FBI, who knew where she was all along, to bring her home and make a great big story. And nothing was so spectacular as the capture of Patty Hearst. It had the same inkling of building up Mr. Charlie Bates in San Francisco that J. Edgar Hoover had when he captured Alvin Creepy Karpus, that made him really important in the FBI. That was his big story. And Mr. Bates had been discredited for many good reasons constantly. So Patty was delivered back to San Francisco, back to her hometown, back to her mother and father. And that episode is not ended, but she was captured 3 weeks to the day from the time that I said she would be captured on Dialogue Conspiracy. I think I'll use the remaining 15 minutes to read you this press conference that was held August 21st, 1975, just a month ago today, or yesterday, about Patty Hearst, about the SLA, because this was held in San Francisco. It was a statement made by Lake Headley, private investigator on this whole SLA affair, and he gave a copy to Randolph Hearst, which I have here, and I want to read you what he said, his investigation into this affair, so that you'll know what kind of material Randolph Hearst had and why I also knew then it had to be over. The letter sent from Lake Headley to Randolph Hearst was registered July 21st, 1975. Lake Headley told him that I have served since May of 74 as an official member, official family investigator for the families of the SLA killed in Los Angeles on May 17th. Incidentally, it was my call to Willie Wolf's father who told him to get, he wanted a lawyer in California, and I recommended Don Freed and Lake Headley, and that's how Lake Headley got into this case. He went on with his press conference. He said, May 10th, 1974, at a press conference, I warned of the impending disaster being planned by the FBI involving Donald DeFries and those with him. May 17, 1974, the disaster befell Donald DeFries and five people all met death with him. This year-long investigation conducted by myself and my associates has uncovered evidence of FBI illegal acts, impropriety, and a cover-up. I make the following statements because I feel that I cannot continue to serve those who place their trust in me without calling the FBI illegalities to the attention of the American people in the hopes of averting further acts of the Federal Bureau investigation that are going to lead to the repetition of May 17, 1974. He said on June 20th, 1974, Mr. Wayne Lewis, former undercover agent of the FBI, met with Lake Headley. He produced documents, identified himself, and said that he was formerly employed by Clarence Kelly. As I say, he was an undercover agent, and he worked for the FBI from 1968 to 1974. His cover was blown by a woman named Julie Clifford, a female employee of the FBI, and he met Donald DeFries in San Francisco in July 1973 in the San Francisco area. He met with Donald DeFries, and he talked with him subsequent to his escape. And from prison, he talked to him, and then he met him later in the San Francisco area. The meeting of Mr. Lewis and DeFries was reported to Donald Gray, an FBI agent, squad leader, Los Angeles, an FBI office, who worked as a partner Wayne Lewis. Gray told Lewis that DeFries was an FBI informant and that he had gotten out of hand. They called him uncontrollable and that he was going to be removed as the head of the SLA. Donald Gray asked Lewis to take DeFries' place as the leader once they got rid of DeFries. Lewis had left the L.A. area for a while, said he would advise later, and he went to South Dakota, where he was May 17th when the shootout occurred. Donald Gray told him then that he had personally shot DeFries, and now the way to clear was clear to take over the SLA. I interject here in my Realist article, the SLA is the CIA, that DeFries was shot at close range by a man who ran down the alley and had a special killing that was not the SWAT team. And Donald Gray told him he personally shot and killed DeFries. Gray told Mr. Lewis DeFries was an informant for the LAPD as well as the FBI. He told him he would have to take the case, whether he wanted to or not, in order to get back pay. And there's a legal maneuver going on now between Mr. Lewis and the FBI for back pay. R.G. Farwell, the head of criminal conspiracy section, black section, that agent provocateur Lewis Tack would work with, told Lake Healy that DeFries was going to be killed by the feds. Lewis had arranged contact with Patty Hearst in June 74, 1 month after the shootout, and he was about to meet her. He talked to her on the telephone, and he was about to meet her. And FBI agent Donald Gray is now teaching at the FBI Academy at Quantico, Virginia. He claims he's a gun freak, and Lewis believes that the gun that killed DeFries is still in the possession of FBI agent Donald Gray. All this material I'm reading to you was presented at a press conference and never made the Associated Press or the United Press, but these are allegations and facts that could be proved or disproved, but the major media and the investigative agencies are too afraid that this all may prove true. The allegations go on that Lewis claims, Wayne Lewis, knew of and had access to high-level FBI plans and activities through Gray due to his uncle, L. Patrick Gray, forming acting director at the time of these occurrences. He said Gray and other police officers from the LAPD, Los Angeles officers, and others warned him that orders had been given from high FBI sources that Patricia Hearst was not to be taken alive under any circumstances. Now, this was held at a press conference charging the FBI with a man named Gray, giving his alias, giving him facts. And Patricia Hearst had to be returned alive to her parents. If any one of these facts or any more of these provocateurs come forward, imagine what it would do to the FBI. So this was one of the major reasons that I believed that she had to be produced, or why this Mr. Arms was saying, I can find her for a fee, and not letting you know that he was also related to a CIA operation in Mexico. The press conference went on to say that the code name for Donald Gray, the nephew of Patrick Gray, was Dave Groves. The FBI agents assert that they know and knew where Patty Hearst is. Now, this was a month before she came in. This press conference, as I say, was in July 75 and in August 75. At this time, they knew where she was, but the underground is protected. All the underground is protected so that the Bureau, the FBI, can build a wide-range file on any potential subversives. This was the purpose of letting them float around. The underground is protected without knowledge of the fugitives, and in the case of the SLA, the FBI even tried to replace the dead leadership. In other words, the few were infiltrated, and without necessarily knowing that they were FBI, they're getting all the help and all the safe, and they're not being brought in. It's without the knowledge of the fugitives. They're not working with them. They're hiding, in quotes hiding, but the safe houses and the Pentagon and the CIA and the FBI knew where they were. One of the kidnappers of Patricia Hearst, named C.R. Moody, he surfaced a short while back with various weapons and was linked to the SLA. He is subsequently employed by the FBI in Colorado. The FBI is now covering up Moody's wave of violence in Colorado while he was an employee of the FBI. The FBI continues to suppress a letter on the dead body of Camilla Hall that was found, and this letter contains vital information concerning the group dynamics of the SLA. Now, that was a press conference held in San Francisco, and this document was given to Randolph Hearst July 21st, 1975. And the question is, how much did Mr. Hearst know? How much did the FBI know or the CIA know? I had the feeling that Mr. Hearst was in the company of the FBI constantly, that after the shootout, after the Patty dogs went up and sniffed that house, and he was sure that she wasn't in it, and that the dogs stayed out on the street, and he was in telephonic contact with the FBI, the Hearst family just sent away all the cameras, sent away the investigators, and sat calm and realized that she was in safe hands. And one reason it's so important to go into the use, the Las Vegas links, the connections to this thing, is the one of the things that I wrote in my article was the Las Vegas connections that always show up. The closing off of the desert in 1974. In the article I did for the Barb is SLA Sinview, the first black Lee Harvey Oswald. I asked about those 12.5 million acres of California desert that were closed off. And we still don't know how the Patty Hearst getaway went from Los Angeles to Las Vegas. And if somebody high up in California government closed that off, an excuse was dune buggies, but that's a lot of acres to be closed off for a few dune buggies. And I think until we know who closed that off and how many dune buggies were using the road, and if it was used as an escape route, we don't know which California officials were linked to the LAPD or for the plans just a month later that there was going to be need for an escape or a shootout. Now, the capture of Patty Hearst made the news in a strange way. The acting head of the FBI out in San Francisco, Charlie Bates, was saying, we don't know how we got her. It was a fluke. We were looking for somebody involved in a bank robbery in Sacramento. Patty Hearst was first discovered. She was laughing. Neighbors heard her outside laughing. Then she was peeing in her pants. And then came those usual human interest stories of, does she play canasta? Are they playing hearts? She wanted a television, and she got it. The Harrises are a little indignant. They're not very good inmates. She's very polite and refined. That we get all the little stories that she used to make quiche for Stephen Weed, and will he see her or won't he see her? And did she keep the flowers in her cell, or did she give them to the matron? And she got a white orchid, and all these little details were going on this week. And they're not important to the case at all. They have nothing to do with the case. And I think that there's much more to this. And some of this evidence that they're pulling out of the houses and the garages, we won't know yet if it's planted, like the things that they took out of Lee Harvey Oswald's garage or boxes, whether this actually belonged to them or not. There was an article in the paper this morning saying, on the 22nd, saying there was a split in the ranks of the SLA, William and Emily Harris, as against Ms. Yoshimura and Patty Hearst. Well, now the SLA is supposed to be down to four people, and there's a split in the ranks. And I had alleged right from the beginning of this thing, or right shortly afterwards in my research, that Emily and William Harris were responsible for manipulating Patty Hearst, and they were the control for Patty Hearst, that they were probably, I say probably, it would have to be checked out, the same role that Mr. Wayne Lewis was to have as the Donald DeFries leader. I haven't found out whether he is a black replacement or a white replacement, but evidently the Scotts and the Harrises had some part in keeping, they kept Patty alive, they kept her happy, they went traveling around, and now the Harrises were into more violence or more bombing, which is an interesting concept because Patty really is getting the brunt of these charges. And the Harrises, according to some notes found in Patty's possession, wanted to be even more violent. And I asked the question in my SLA article, how come the last time that Patty was seen in Hollywood, she was seen with two black men and a woman at Mrs. Alcala's apartment, and because she was turned down for not being given a room for the night, The price was $500. Patty was supposed to have said, "You want to die." I bring this point up because the Harrises weren't mentioned in this particular death threat or crime. Two black men were mentioned. Yet after D.A. Bush pressed those charges that next Monday, the Harrises were in charge of Patty, and they took her off. But Patty was left with the charges, but the black men weren't sought. And nobody said the Harrises had black makeup or looked like two men. So the Harrises led Patty Hearst to the Mel's Sporting Goods store, where a pair of socks and a bandolier were allegedly stolen. A police student from one of the academies was there with handcuffs, didn't catch them. Patty was supposed to have done the shooting at the building. There really isn't any witness who could identify her as doing the shooting. She was supposed to have been doing all that wild shooting. She's getting the charges for that. The Harrises aren't getting the charges for that shooting. Patty is. Patty, they took her in a van with this Tom Matthews and introduced her, and the Harrises said, "You know who this is? This is Tanya." And until then, Patty wasn't really a suspect in the bank robbery, the Hibernia Bank, even though she was photographed there. And the Harrises eked a confession out of Patty at the back of the van with Tom Matthews that she did the bank robbery. And now, as they're arrested in San Francisco, there's a note there, Patty Hearst, that the Harrises want to get her into even more violence. And then we hear on the radio today that somebody involved with the food program, an elderly person who wanted to free Patty Hearst, will now be charged with wanting to kill the president, linking it to the Hearst case, just like Squeaky Fromm did to the Manson case. The interweaving links go on and on and on. They're very complicated. The best thing, I think, for those of you who are interested in the Hearst case, who are new at listening at KLRB in the last week or weeks or months, who are not familiar with it because I haven't talked about it for a while, could order the article I have on Why Was Patricia Hearst Kidnapped. You can write to KLRB in Carmel, California, Box 3904. And, excuse me, I'll send you that copy of The Realist, Why Was Patricia Hearst Kidnapped? It's a full book-length article on the involvement of the FBI, the collusion of the FBI, and the CIA, and the media, and that this is part of a behavior modification testing program from Stanford Research, and that this plot involves high-level government officials. And if this nephew, Patrick Gray, is right, that his uncle, who was acting director of the FBI, was in the FBI at the time this was taking place, we have a lot to investigate. I think it's easier to investigate these things than more important and more timely than even who killed John Kennedy. I don't agree with Senator Kennedy that we shouldn't open it up, and I resent the position of the Kennedy family. But what I was trying to say at the Boston conferences, and what I try to do in my weekly radio broadcast, is to tell you these things are going to come down. There's going to be a lot of violence in America. There's going to be one assassination for sure that's going to take place. That will affect the electoral process. One of the two men is going to be murdered, and there is a pattern, and there are agencies and places that link together. And I had hoped that the other researchers that worked on the John Kennedy assassination or Robert Kennedy assassination would have taken the same interest I did into the Manson family and into the Patricia Hearst kidnapping, because it's all part and parcel of the same program, and it's going to lead to terrorism, it's going to lead to violence, it's going to lead to bloodshed in this country that began in Dallas when John Kennedy was assassinated in 1963. And as I said when I began the program, the same persons were in office, are in office, or still hold important positions of government that were part of the original conspiracy, including Gerald Ford, a member of the Warren Commission. Well, our time is up. I'll see you next week on Dialogue Conspiracy. Take care of yourselves, and we'll be around next week.
This has been Dialogue Conspiracy with political research specialist Mae Brussel, who for 10 years has been researching the facts behind political assassinations and conspiracies in this country. Dialogue Conspiracy originates with KLRB-FM in Carmel, California.